Hello, welcome to this podcast interview with Roberto Polli, a pianist and teacher whose upcoming book I saw announced in Classical News and who caught my eye because of a particular phrase he was quoted as saying in that announcement. To really understand music, one needs to be more subjective. It's a subject that I don't know if you already know, but I love looking at music from a very personal point of view. So it intrigued me to talk to Roberto, and I wrote him an email, and this interview is the result of that. His upcoming book is called The Secret Life of Musical Notation, Defying Interpretive Traditions. It's a very intriguing title. Enjoy the interview. Thanks for listening. Hello, welcome to this podcast interview with Roberto Polli. Roberto, I see that you were born in Venice, Italy, and you are Italian, and you grew up in Italy, and then you eventually came to the U.S. to study after much education in Italy, and your current position now, you're chair of the piano department and artist in residence at the River School Conservatory. And how long have you been in that position?
I've been the artist in residence for about, 8 years, and the chair of the piano department since last year. This is my second year.
It's
a wonderful faculty, actually. It's a wonderful.
Yes. There was some kind of a story now that I didn't see in your bio, but where one of the faculty there sort of remembered speaking to you about something and then sort of invited you to come teach there. Am I wrong about that, or was it?
It's Angel Ramon Rivera, who's a dear friend of mine. He's a true Bostonian, even though he's from originally from Puerto Rico, and he came to Boston to study piano when he was a teenager and taught the pedagogy course at the New England Conservatory, mm-hmm. and I was forced, actually, since I was taking the course, to observe his classes, and it was a wonderful experience, actually, in retrospect, and we became great friends, and he's been very, very supportive of my work.
Is he still on the faculty there?
He is. And he, when he learned that I was looking for a job, he pulled some levers and tried whatever he could do to get me on the faculty. And
yes. Well, I just remember seeing that, you know, he spoke of you in glowing terms.
He's a wonderful friend. I mean, he's
yeah.
really supportive and a wonderful musician and artist, really.
So I'm... the reason I found your name, actually, was in relation to a book that you will be releasing soon, an article reviewing it, and I reviewed
That's
it
right.
on my blog, and then I decided to call you up and see if you were willing to do an interview. So let's jump to that subject right away, and then we can fill in other details later. So the book is called The Secret Life of Musical Notation, Defying Interpretive Traditions. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that title and how you came to that title and what it all means?
Sure. This is a book that developed over the course of several years, and it's a book that, in a way, is responsible indirectly for changing my playing.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, and this has been happening to me for over a decade, Before I started writing the book,
mm-hmm.
There were symbols in the music, symbols and signs that I found inconclusive. Sometimes their placement was nonsensical,
mm-hmm.
And you know, sometimes I thought I had the necessity to determine the original meaning of these symbols, because to me they made absolutely no sense.
Now, could you give me a couple of examples of what you mean by specific, which symbols are you talking
sure.
about?
I'm talking about symbols like sforzando, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And what we call crescendo and diminuendo hairpins. This latter topic is actually something that other people have developed over the last few years, but it's something that I discovered on my own. I was on a train, actually, on my way to Rome for a recital, and I was looking at the music singing in my head, and you know, like most musicians do on the train sometimes. And I had this revelation that actually those symbols did not mean what we all think they mean, perhaps a little presumptuously. But, you know, it was a discovery that actually changed my musical life, because that actually opened all sorts of speculations about other symbols as well, and those are the symbols that I discuss in my book.
Now, when were you referring to sort of an Urtext edition that was supposedly, you know, as close to an exact copy of what the composer wrote, or was this an edition that somebody else put out? In other words, were those sort of Chopin's, was it Chopin's music you were noticing? Is that what you said?
That's right. It was in the Polonaise Fantasy by Chopin. What I was referring to when I mentioned hairpins, it's that, at least in piano music, and this is actually something that is obviously open to many interpretations in the music for other instruments, in orchestral music, for instance. But in piano music, what I discovered in Chopin is that those opening and closing gestures actually don't mean crescendo and diminuendo as we all think they do.
Mm.
They have different designations that could be agogic, meaning pertaining to the timing. An opening hairpin might mean to broaden the speed, and a closing to go back to speed after taking some time, after lingering on a note or a group of notes.
Really? Interesting.
And but then, because I got really into the analysis of these markings, I actually noticed how sometimes they were accompanied by other markings that would contradict them. For instance, a closing hairpin sometimes appears with the word crescendo right in the middle.
Huh.
It's perhaps not typical of Chopin, but it happens actually in a few occasions. And the opposite is also true, the word diminuendo and an opening hairpin. Sometimes you have hairpins that close and open at the same time, perhaps for the two hands, one hairpin for each hand. And so, you know, I actually used what I will call maybe deductive reasoning, I guess. You know, I tried to make sense musically, musical sense of these symbols, and I discovered that in Chopin, and that's true for other composers as well, Schubert especially, a closing hairpin in, under the left hand or above the right hand might mean voicing for that specific hand, meaning that hand should be dynamically prominent compared to the other. Or perhaps there's an inner line that needs to be brought out that he wouldn't know how to notate, and so he uses hairpins to do that.
Yeah,
not giving it away so easily, but, you know, this is before the book comes out. But,
well, that just gives me an idea of the concepts behind your book. So in your book, do you basically go through certain specific pieces and give your ideas on these, or do you generalize them to all Chopin's music, or what's the sort of structure?
Well, this discovery in Chopin actually led me to analyze music from other eras as well, and I learned, for instance, about hairpins. And by the way, hairpins are the subject of my the first chapter. I noticed that hairpins appear for the first time consistently, at least in Haydn. Around 1790, 1789 precise, and it's a it's fascinating to see how these symbols, this is actually the focus of the core of the book, is that we have one way of reading these symbols, but in reality, composers in the 1700s, at the end of the 1700s, were starting to use all these symbols for the first time, and over the decades, those symbols actually changed in meaning, even within the works of the same composer. You know, but what I discovered is that we actually apply one meaning. Well, I didn't discover it. I noticed that we tend to read mechanically a symbol in a certain way, and it applies to the music of Haydn or Prokofiev the same way. We don't have, you know, we don't know how these markers actually evolved over the decades.
Yeah, that's true. It could be like words evolve within meaning. Sometimes words sort of change meanings over time. And so if you take the meaning that it has, you know, now and assume that it means the same thing in John Donne's poetry, it may not.
That's right.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, I look forward to getting it.
Well, the hairpins have a very specific history, but there are symbols that perhaps apply more generally to other instruments as well, like sforzando. Rinforzando is another symbol that marking that I analyze. Then I talk about rhythmic values and how over the decades rhythmic values have changed their designation in music. You know, sometimes we read, say, a dotted eighth note and a sixteenth note as a figuration, you know, in a very specific way, especially when it's in the context of a writing in triplets, and we don't think how perhaps that sixteenth note might coincide with the third note of the triplet in certain contexts. You know, that's something that the Baroque composers do all the time. But we read it so mechanically that we actually enforce this sense of rigidity in the rhythm, and perhaps there's something wrong about that, you know.
Interesting. They're very interesting questions, and it sounds like you really explored the subject quite deeply and thoughtfully. So I'm looking forward to seeing what your suggestions are and your solutions to some of those problems. So jumping back a bit to the beginning of your musical career, what was it like growing up in Italy and studying with wonderful teachers and going to wonderful music schools there? Tell us a little bit about your upbringing as a musician.
Sure. I started actually quite late. I was 12 years old, and it's rather common in Italy, you know, unlike the United States, where children start very early, as early as 5 or 4. You know, kids usually don't start until they're 10, maybe even 11, 12, and sometimes actually when you're a teenager. And so there's a big chunk of time that is in a way wasted, which you know, you previously asked me about the difference between American schools and Italian schools. And it's interesting because I see children who are 10 years old who play something that I played when I was 16. And at that age, that's actually a big chunk of time.
yes, it is. But you know, I was thinking, it's funny, I was kind of thinking along a little different line of thinking that how nice that a kid actually gets to still be a kid until they're like 12 and not be crammed into a practice room at age 4. You get in there and practice.
It's true, but you know, I think that is a problem that is besides the musical education. I think it's a problem with the latest generation. I think, you know, I see how my students who are teenagers are overscheduled, and they try to do everything and you know, all sorts of disciplines. When I was a kid, I had one thing, and that was the piano.
And I noticed the same thing with my private students. you know, they have tennis lessons and dance lessons and singing lessons and piano lessons and then soccer and then football and marching band and, you know.
And, you know, and some of them actually managed to do a few things quite well, you know.
Yeah.
But my impression is that this is perhaps the difference between the two systems, the Italian system, which, by the way, is rather flawed for other reasons, and the American system. It's that, in a way, having one thing that you did well perhaps develops a passion, a long-lasting passion early on, whereas my impression is that this generation of teenagers now, they have so many things that I'm not sure they manage to actually get passionate about anything specific.
Yeah, they don't explore something deeply.
That's right. They don't live with one thing long enough, you know?
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. It's a fine line. I think variety is good, but I think, you know, a student needs to be able to find their a deeper root into something. That makes a lot of sense.
I mean, I think actually parents, I mean, these kids are so fortunate that the parents allow them to have all these things. It's wonderful, you know. I wish I had some of that variety when I was a kid. You know, my family was not wealthy, and so we have three kids. I have two brothers. You know, they had to see where the money was going and try to carve out the right place for each one of us.
Are either of your brothers musicians?
No, I'm the only one. I'm the black sheep of the family.
Or the white sheep.
I did music, the one who left.
So your family then is still back in Italy?
They're all back there, yes. And I'm a bad child. I don't go visit.
You don't?
No, I haven't been there in a while. In a few
years. I'll go visit for you. I'm looking for an excuse to go to Italy.
Oh, they love visitors, so you can go.
Yeah. Wow, I wasn't serious, but I appreciate that. It's very sweet of you. So I'd like to talk a little bit more about your teaching now.
Sure.
As a teacher, I have a feeling, you know, you're a very creative teacher. I don't know, I didn't read that anywhere, but I'm guessing that you are, because it sounds like you're sort of a creative thinker. How do you approach running a piano studio? How many students do you generally have at the conservatory there?
You know, it varies. I also have some private students who come to the house. I would say I have probably about 30 students at this point.
Wow, that's quite a few.
It's a handful. And it's my inability to say no. I have to say I love teaching. It's something that I feel very passionately about. And I like to think that I'm allowing my students to develop their own voice. I think that's something that is missing today. You know, one thing that I noticed in the teaching of some of my teachers and the teaching of some of the teachers who surround me is that it's about doing what they say. You know, it's about imitating. It's about copying what they are teaching. And, and inevitably, while I understand there has to be a structure to the work, I like to think that my students should not hear me demonstrate something for them all the time, because inevitably they end up sounding like me. And that is possibly one of the biggest problems in the playing of many people today. There's something that I discuss in my book. Well, it has to do with recordings and how they affected our perception of how music, quote unquote, should go. You know, when you hear something that is unusual, very often I hear the comment, "But this is not how it goes."
Right. Right.
And that's such a problem, I think, with having so many recordings of everything available.
Yeah.
And the point I make is that that 19th century musicians heard a piece for the first time probably when they read it from
yeah.
the music that they just bought at the music store, or perhaps
yeah.
they heard it in a concert, but they didn't have anything that actually told them exactly how to interpret it, because
mm-hmm.
all they had was the memory of maybe one performance, and maybe
mm-hmm.
even from the composer himself.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
we have recordings, you know, we push a button and we can actually copy every single detail of an interpretation of, say, Martha Argerich playing. Well, that's a very very
mm-hmm.
good thing to imitate in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
But
of
at
course.
The same time, you know, we create a standard in piano playing, which is that, or in the playing of any instrument, in my case, of piano playing, because we have one way, or say several ways of seeing
mm-hmm.
a piece of music or a passage. We don't
mm-hmm.
have our own way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I discovered that the more I demonstrate for my students when I teach, the more they end up sounding like me. And
mm-hmm.
I it's flattering, but at the same time, I'm not sure I want that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my philosophy.
Uh-huh.
And I really encourage them to find their own voice. That's my mission as a teacher, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from, you know, all the technical work and, you know,
yes, of course.
Something
that, do you generally have sort of a routine method that you go through, certain standard works that each student works on to progress to different levels, or do you kind of get creative with each student and map out a sort of a...
Well, yeah, I think that actually each student has to have some kind of tailored program that
mm-hmm.
suits his needs. I don't
mm-hmm.
think there's a standardized program that one should follow. It's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Because we all grow at different stages and with different qualities. And
mm-hmm.
you know, there's one quote, if I may quote Chopin himself. He said, piano schools today, and he's talking about the 1840s, tried to
mm-hmm.
develop evenness in the fingers. But, you know, fingers are all different. So we should develop their unique qualities rather than evenness among them.
Wow, that's a great quote.
Yes, I think it's the same thing for students. You know, you have
mm-hmm.
a bunch of students, and you can't expect them to develop at the same pace and to sound exactly the same. As a matter of fact, I love the fact that all my students sound different.
Wow, well, that's a testament to your teaching style. How wonderful!
Well, I think I came to that idea a while ago, and I think it's the only way to get away from this standardized playing that is typical of today's performers. I think
yeah.
it's a necessary step.
Yes, indeed. There's so much to cover in your life. I'm going to jump a little bit here again. I'd like to
sure.
have you tell me what it felt like to prepare for your debut recording album in 2002. Shall We Dance, which of course has Ravel waltzes and waltzes from Der Rosenkavalier arranged. So tell us about how you decided that you chose that music and how you prepared for the recording, and, you know, perhaps a story of the recording itself, how, you know, how things went or didn't go well for you.
Sure. It's not easy to describe how that CD came together, but it wasn't actually my idea. I have to credit John Bell Young
mm-hmm.
for that. He's a producer of the CD. And I had several pieces that I wanted to record, and La Valse was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And there were the Chopin Mazurkas, and actually some of the Renaissance pieces, the William Byrd, Pavane and Galliard, and the Pavane and Galliard by Orlando Gibbons. And and so he had this idea of creating an album that would be gathering all these dances from different time periods. And actually what happened while we were having that idea together is that Robert Helps, the American composer Robert Helps, passed away. And he wrote a piece titled Shall We Dance, which is a fiendishly difficult piece. It's a very, very difficult piece. And Russell Sherman, my teacher, had just recorded it. And so I thought I wanted to play it. And I had played it at that point. Right before he passed away, I learned it. And I just happened to record it in that also titled the CD, which is a perfect title for it, I think.
I look forward to. I don't have it, but I look forward to getting it and listening to it. And you mentioned William Byrd, that you put some of his stuff on Shall We Dance, but you're planning to do an all William Byrd album coming up?
Yes. Well, that was an idea that started quite a few years ago, and it hasn't happened yet for a simple reason that I have shifted my focus on Chopin for a while, and maybe in a couple of years I'll return to it. I did record some of it, and so it's a matter of recording more material, but it's a selection of 14 pieces from My Lady Neville's book, which is a collection of pieces that Byrd put together in 1591 for this mysterious Lady Neville. No one knows who she is. And it's a wonderful collection of pieces. Some of them don't work well on the piano, but some of them are so perfect for the piano. And not sure actually what my take would be today. I've played Elizabethan music for nearly 20 years. And I'm not sure. I haven't played it in a while. I'm not sure what my take would be on it today, but certainly the idea of counterpoint, which is so incredible in William Byrd, it's so florid and virtuosic, and I'm not sure that the idea of imitating the virginal, which is the instrument he used, is valid anymore, but certainly something that reveals the character of the pieces.
On piano. Yeah.
That's correct,
So finding an interpretation that somehow is perhaps an extension of or inspired by the way it might sound. Okay, so we were interrupted by my phone dying. So here we are again with Roberto Poli, and he's going to hopefully continue where he was talking about William Byrd. So you were saying?
We were talking about how perhaps I was going to imitate the early instruments on the piano, but I'm not sure that I have the same take today. And I think it's a very difficult issue. I think not to play those instruments and try to imagine what they, you know, how. William Byrd, for instance, would have played his own music on an instrument from the 1500s. It's a very difficult issue to.
Sure, and as you said, a lot of interpretive markings came later with Haydn.
That's right.
There's probably less information in the markings in earlier music than we even especially we see
there's
nowadays.
There's absolutely nothing.
Yeah,
so it's up to us to imagine It's a very interesting issue, you know, how composers at a point discovered that being more accurate about what they wanted to hear in their own music developed notation, but before people were simply learning, part of their training was to learn how to inflect expressively, how to I guess the character of a piece and apply it to their it's something that certainly they didn't have in the Elizabethan era.
I know that during Mozart's time, of course, you hear about improvisation being done, and even in Beethoven's time, in many of the concertos, there was a cadenza section, which is improvised often on the spot, and also that ornamentation was often added, even though it was necessarily marked in the music. Was that also a tradition? Has that been discovered through texts in the Elizabethan era? Was that also a factor in that, in improvising sections?
Well, you know, we don't actually know because there's very little that people wrote about interpretation back then. I mean, there are just a few accounts. There were no treatises or essays on interpretation. Those began to come out in the 1750s with a little earlier with certain string methods, but you know, not the way we intend methods today, certainly. People tried things more than analyze them and discuss them at length, like the method would do. And so it's hard to say. We don't actually know what they did. There is certainly margin for improvisation in the music of William Byrd or Orlando Gibbons or John Bull. What I find really interesting is the amount of ornamentation actually already included, mostly trills of different length. And to the extent that sometimes you have a trill every other note in certain passages. And perhaps actually it's a case that they left out some of them because they were too difficult. You know, so
yes.
The reverse operation.
right. Removing a bit of the of the writing. Yeah, I'm sure those ornamentations were also probably to emphasize because the virginal was not a very loud instrument, right?
Yes, but I think that the issue was actually more about convenience. I mean, imagine that most of this music, that its fruition was, you know, the private setting of a music room, or perhaps even a bedroom, or, you know, a family room in a home. And certainly it didn't leave those walls. There was no sense of, you know, projection of sound the way an issue that we have today, because we have to perform in concert halls. I mean, the whole family lived differently. It was an intimate experience. Sharing experience.
Yeah, I hope to get back to that kind of thing with more chamber music concerts. You know, I think a lot of the intimacy of music sharing is lost in big concert halls.
Absolutely.
You know,
and also most of the music we play was not written, or at least piano music, you know, until the 1850s. That music was not really written for the concert halls. And so any sonata by Beethoven was not intended to be played in Carnegie Hall, certainly. It was meant to be shared with friends and family in a living room. As a result, the instruments were not as brilliant for that reason. You know, they didn't need to be so loud.
Yeah.
The space.
Yeah. Well, I think, didn't Beethoven have a special piano made that was louder for him or something?
That's right, but he was also he also had some hearing problems, which we don't actually I don't think we know why he wanted a louder instrument, because he certainly had a distorted sense of what it would sound like.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know, that got more and more introspective and bizarre, too.
Yeah.
For that reason, because he couldn't hear.
But, yeah.
Yeah, piano makers would make instruments for him. He said, you know, I want more fingers, I want more keys.
Yeah.
And that's what he said, you know. So, yeah.
Have you ever heard of that book, The Piano Shop on the Left Bank?
I've always heard the title, but I've never read it.
Oh, it's an absolutely delightful read. You will just love it. It's so well written, and of course, it takes place all in Paris, and it's just a beautiful little book. It just really, I have an older piano from 1919. I used to play when I was in high school, and this is a MacPhail, which was made in Boston through the 1950s. And
what's the maker? I'm sorry.
MacPhail, MCPHAIL,
huh.
And they were competition for Steinway, certainly in quality, and they specialized in the smaller living room grands, and that's what I have. And it's an absolutely delightful instrument, extremely well made, and a gorgeous sound, and at, you know, 1/10 the price of a Steinway. So, MacPhail, I have an intimate relationship with this instrument, with this particular sound, and a lot of that inspiration came from reading this book, The Piano Shop on the Left Bank, where he talks about sort of the individual sound of each instrument and how it changes over time and how it changes depending on who's playing it, and I think you would really like it.
You know, I actually even own it. Someone gave it to me, but I never read it. So
I think you should. Yeah, I pick it up again and just start, and you'll see. I think with my introduction.
Yeah, we can. It's always get piano related books, and then they pile up.
I'm doing the same thing, researching a future book of mine, and it's hard to squeeze in any pleasurable reading. So, but. Now, you also, in addition to being an accomplished piano recitalist and recording artist and to be soon to be published author, you're also a painter, it says in your bio. Why don't you tell me a little bit about your painting as we sort of wind down the interview.
It's a passion that has developed over a number of years, and I'm not sure where it's going. It's not, you know, it's a pure hobby, I would
mm-hmm.
say.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. I don't always have time to spend with it, but when I do, I really enjoy it, and I think it's something that really keeps me out of trouble in periods, you know.
Do you paint kind of abstract paintings, or do you paint still lifes? Or
I do a little bit of everything. I try to. I've never got into the abstract really, but I tend to do portraits and landscape,
mm-hmm.
things like that. So it's not. I'm fairly. Middle of the road kind of painter, but mm-hmm. it's something that I enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also have a similar hobby. I'm a gardener. I love gardening, and I just do it for the fun of it. I don't try to impress anybody, and I also enjoy writing poetry once in a while, and I might even pull together a small personal book of poetry. I've done it once, sort of on a personal scale, and self-published it for friends, and I may do the same with all my poems and just put it together in an informal volume and publish it simply, just to say, you know, this is what I have done. So, Roberto, it's really been a pleasure talking to you. I, of course, have gotten to know you a little bit better just through this conversation, but I really hope we can meet someday and perhaps play chamber music together. I would like that.
Wonderful. Yeah.
I saw that you'd worked with Jonathan Kohler.
That's right. Yeah.
I'm, you know, familiar with him from Facebook and the clarinet.
He's a great guy.
Yes, and
the
very
the place and
also very passionate about historical references in music and stuff like that. He seems like a really well-rounded performer and player.
He's wonderful. I mean, the amazing thing is that he doesn't seem to practice, but he always plays perfectly and with great virtuosity. I think there's a performance of the Luigi Bassi Fantasy on Rigoletto online, the two of us playing. So if you find it,
yeah,
give it a listen.
I'll look for that. Oh yeah,
actually,
I haven't performed that, but I mean, I it's sort of on my to-do list. I've done the Traviata Fantasy, the Lovrello or something. It's a different arranger. But I'll look for the Bassi.
He's really, I mean, the piano part is nothing, but you know, it's a live performance and from a few years ago, and we played quite a few times together.
Wonderful.
But he's quite a character. wonderful person, really.
Well, I look forward to meeting him someday too.
Yeah.
So, Roberto, any last words, any final comments before we sign off?
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. And
you're welcome.
It's great to be here in your interview.
Again, I look forward to meeting you, and thanks for taking the time. All right, good night.
Thank you. Thank you. Good night.
Thanks for listening. Until next time, I wish you many enjoyable musical experiences, the first of which is this performance by this week's guest. This is David Thomas signing off. Now for the music. Thank you.
This is an audio file from onclassical.com. Go to our site to download the complete album in hi-fi quality.